Hello, I am reading selections from the Provincetown Independent, dated January 26th, 2023. The first story is entitled Car Crashes into OCHS Lobby in Wellfleet. No one was seriously injured, and the health clinic quickly reopened, by Sam Pollock. Wellfleet. A white Audi sedan operated by Greta Einig, 74, drove into the Outer Cape Health Services OCHS office on Route 6 shortly after 9:30 a.m. on January 18th, according to Wellfleet Police Chief Michael Hurley. The car was lodged halfway into the health center's lobby, just inches away from the glass windows facing the room where approximately half a dozen people had been waiting, said Hurley. There were no serious injuries, Hurley said, and no one was taken to the hospital. Three minor injuries were evaluated at the scene, he said. Everybody has been extremely lucky, OCHS CEO Pat Nadel told The Independent. It was traumatizing for everybody, but people mobilized. The police, the fire department, and the building inspector all came out to help. The town has been so responsive. The car was dislodged from the building and the scene cleared by 3 p.m. that day. The incident is currently under investigation, said Chief Hurley. He hopes it will be completed by the end of this week. No charges had been issued as of January 23rd, and Hurley said it is more than likely that Einig will not be charged. It's not common that anyone is charged if it is just one person that's involved, he said. OCHS Assistant Facilities Manager Kevin Sweeney said that security footage showed the car pulling into the parking lot from Route 6 and then quickly accelerating as it approached a parking space facing the building. He surmised the accident was caused by a pedal error. Reached at her home in Wellfleet, Einig declined to comment. OCHS reopened its doors on Friday, January 20th, 2 days after the incident. A temporary wood-framed exterior bearing wall was built pending permits for permanent repairs, said Building Inspector James Badera. Approximately 7 feet of the exterior bearing wall between the waiting room and an unoccupied office was damaged. 11 feet of interior non-bearing partition was damaged as well, along with parts of the office's HVAC and electrical systems, Badera said. They've been removed from service until they can be repaired. According to Badera's visual observations and the building plans, the damage did not compromise the overall structural integrity of the building, he said. This was confirmed at the site by Marshall Puffer of Coastal Engineering, the firm that did the structural engineering design when the building was renovated in 2018. OCHS Communications Officer Gary Desautels said that OCHS hopes to complete all repairs off hours within the next 2 months. Desautels also said that OCHS is looking into installing bollards at every parking space facing the building. There are 15 spaces facing the building, but only 3 spaces reserved for handicap parking currently have bollards. Hurley said that while incidents like this one are alarming, they are not common. It's not a monthly or even a yearly thing, Hurley said, but they do happen every once in a while. Nationwide statistics paint a different picture. Studies conducted by the Storefront Safety Council, SSC, estimated that there are at least 100 car-into-building crashes every day nationally. That is 36,500 such crashes per year. According to the SSC, 39% of these crashes involve drivers over age 60, and 41% are caused by operator error, including pedal error. But an audit done for Lloyd's of London by CHC Global, a risk management company, suggested that this estimate may be a lowball. It concluded that SSC may be counting as few as one in every 91 crashes. SSC's database of 36,000 crashes is compiled from anecdotal and media reports, court records, fire department-run records, and published studies, its website says. It's a real public safety concern, said Rob Reiter, founder of the Storefront Safety Council. Especially in places like restaurants and health clinics where people usually have their backs to the windows, it can be very hazardous. Ryder surmised that health clinics probably get hit 10 to 15 times a week. Fatalities from such crashes, on the other hand, are rare. In 2020, only 210 people died in fatal collisions with buildings, according to a report done by the Insurance Institute for Highway Safety, HHS. That was 2% of all fixed object crash deaths per year. 46% of object-related crash deaths involved collisions with trees, the study found. Ryder said that the accident OCHS sounds like a pedal error, which is really quite typical. The National Highway Traffic Safety Administration, NHTSA, found that pedal error accidents occur up to 16,000 times every year in the U.S. The NHTSA also notes that drivers under 20 and over 65 are about four times as likely to be involved in pedal confusion accidents as other drivers. Although age may be a factor, Hurley said, it is not a determinant, and the ability to drive past a certain age varies from person to person. Plus, losing one's license can be an added burden for those who do not live near public transit, he said. It's somebody's last piece of freedom, said the chief. You take somebody's license away, and the options shrink pretty quickly on how to get around. It can become devastating. Hurley said that while the crash at OCHS was unfortunate, the outcome was very fortunate. We've seen other places where this has happened, where there have been people seriously injured or killed, he said. It's just very lucky that no one was injured here. The next story is entitled, Two Affordable Housing Developments Ask Neighbors for Money, a Scramble to Close Funding Gaps Caused by Rising Construction Costs, by Christine Laguerre. Provincetown. The community builders have been preparing to build 65 apartments on Jerome Smith Road since they won the bid to do the work in late 2021. But their cost projection rose from $22.3 million then to $37.8 million a year later, and now to $39.4 million. On December 7th, the Boston-based nonprofit developer turned to Wellfleet for help, asking the town's Community Preservation Committee to kick in $500,000 to support Provincetown's project. With limited funds to distribute, Wellfleet decided to keep the money in town. Meanwhile, Preservation of Affordable Housing, POAH, and the Community Development Partnership, CDP, have seen the estimated cost of 46 units of affordable housing on Lawrence Road in Wellfleet go from $20.2 million to $34.4 million by Talia Schlufsky, POAH's senior project manager, told The Independent this week. POAH and the CDP have submitted requests for $100,000 each to Provincetown, Orleans, and Brewster for the Wellfleet project. No decisions have been made on these three requests, but CDP CEO Jay Coburn said, while they share our enthusiasm about the project, they are juggling requests for funding for other projects both within and outside their communities. Every town on the Outer Cape currently has an affordable housing project in the works, Coburn said. POAH and the CDP had also requested $1.5 million in community preservation money from Wellfleet at the December 7th meeting. At that time, committee chair Gary Sorkin told a panel that a total of $1.3 million was available for this year's distribution. Member Rhonda Fowler said the town had been given no assurance that Wellfleet residents would get placed in the units being built in other towns. We're like the tiny cousins sandwiched in between Provincetown and Orleans and Eastham, which are so much further ahead of us in so many ways, Fowler said, lobbying for keeping the money in town for Wellfleet's own project. David Mead Fox agreed. In principle, I like the idea of supporting housing regionally, but only as a Tier 2 priority, Mead Fox said. Tier 1 is Wellfleet. Member Elaine McElroy noted that both Provincetown and Orleans are nearing the state's goal of having 10% of their housing stock qualify as affordable. Our need is huge right now, McElroy said. According to the state's subsidized housing inventory, Provincetown was at 9.7%, Orleans at 9%, and Wellfleet at 2.5% as of December 2020. Besides the request from the community builders for its Provincetown project, two other requests related to affordable housing in Orleans were submitted to Wellfleet Community Preservation Committee. The Housing Assistance Corp requested $100,000 for 14 units planned for Main Street, and Penrose Developers asked for $100,000 for 62 units of affordable, rent-restricted, and workforce housing in the former Cape Cod 5 building. The committee voted unanimously to recommend $1 million for the Lawrence Road project and $20,000 for Penrose's project in Orleans, because it has completed its state funding round and is deemed shovel-ready. The committee voted to defer the requests from the HAC and the community builders. Those projects have not yet gone through the state and federal funding rounds. The bulk of the funding for these affordable housing projects comes through programs overseen by the state's Department of Housing and Community Development, DHCD. They combine state and federal low-income housing tax credits, American Rescue Plan Act funds, project-based state and federal vouchers, the National Housing Trust Fund, the Affordable Housing Trust Fund, and other resources. Besides being needed to cope with inflation-related gaps, the local money helps serve as proof to DHCD that residents of the Outer Cape strongly support increased affordable housing, developers and planners say. The DHCD offers two funding rounds, the main round in the winter and a mini-funding round in June. Developers of both the Wellfleet and Provincetown proposals were invited to participate in the winter round of applications for state and federal funding. POAH and the CDP got the required comprehensive permit in September for the Lawrence Road project, but the state's invitation came later, only after the December commitment of $1 million in local community preservation funds and preliminary approval of $500,000 from the town's Affordable Housing Trust. Wellfleet voters will still have to approve the CPA allocation at this spring's annual town meeting. The developers got their application in on January 19th, deadline day at DHCD. With local permits in hand, the community builders also submitted their application to DHCD for the winter funding round on deadline day, according to Provincetown Town Manager Alex Morse. Now it's a matter of waiting. The state usually makes announcements in the summer, said Morse. With the new administration, the timeline may shift a bit, but I wouldn't expect notice until after May. Morse said the town has committed $3 million in local funds to the project that will be brought to the annual town meeting in April. While they await the DHCD funding decision, there's more funding work for the developers and towns to do. For Provincetown's development, the community builders have made requests for $500,000 each to the community preservation committees of both Truro and Provincetown. If those funds are recommended by the committees, they'll need to be approved at town meetings. The next story is titled, Revised Plan at VFW Prioritizes Lower-Income Units. To qualify for state funding, the number of middle-income units is reduced, by Sophie Mann-Shafir, Provincetown. In an emergency session on January 17th, the Select Board approved a revision of the planned mix of units at the affordable housing development to be built at 3 Jerome Smith Road. The 65 apartments will still be laid out as before, with the same mix of studio, one-bedroom, and two-bedroom units, but rules governing who can live in the apartments had to be changed, according to Lindsay Gale and Andrew Waxman of the Community Builders, TCB, the nonprofit developer that won the right to build the project in October 2021. At that time, Town Manager Alex Morse and other members of the Bid Review Committee had cited TCB's willingness to include middle-income units as a key factor in their winning application. Middle-income units are notoriously hard to build, however. Most state and federal programs that support affordable rental housing are for people with incomes below 80% of area median income, AMI, a number that is calculated every year by the federal government. For Barnstable County in 2022, the median income is $76,100 for a single person and $87,000 for two people. Rental housing for people with incomes above 80% of the median is funded by just one state program with relatively small subsidies, and TCB told the Select Board that the workforce housing formula was going to cap its support to Provincetown's renters at 80% of median income in any case. Renting to those earning more would disqualify the project both for the low-income housing tax credit and for the workforce funding, Waxman said. Instead, TCB recommended a strategy of maximizing federal dollars and minimizing the amount required from the state to make the project more likely to win a competition that began on that same day, January 17th, Gale said. The revised plan allocates 13 units for people earning less than 30% of AMI, $22,000 for one person, up from 9. There will be 32 units, not 36, for people earning between 30 and 60% of AMI. And the 16 units that had been reserved for people earning between 80 and 120% of AMI, $60,000 to $91,000 for one person, will now be for tenants making 80% of AMI or less. The four market-rate rental units will remain unregulated as to income, Gale said. Select Board members worried that the new income mix would exclude middle-income earners, including many town employees who are struggling to find secure housing here. In response to this concern, Gale said that there are municipal employees, even teachers, teachers' assistants, who are eligible for these units. 80% is a workforce tier. Gale also said that the four unrestricted units planned could also serve as higher AMI workforce housing. Despite its concerns, the Select Board approved the revised plan unanimously. "We need a lot more than 65 units," said Select Board member Louise Verdon. "We probably need like 300 units." Picking away at whether and how and which level units the new project would now include is one course of action, Vendon added, but if we shifted those numbers, we would still be meeting a very important community need. Next story is entitled LCAA Medics Say They Can Help the Fire Department. Truvada agrees to hire as many as 16, even if they don't want to fight fires, by Casey Myers. Provincetown. As word spread that the Lower Cape Ambulance Association, LCAA, would close in a few months, requiring Truro and Provincetown to hire 24 medics, so did worry, and not just among residents of the outermost towns who face an hour's drive to the nearest hospital. 17 of the 21 paramedics and EMTs who work for LCAA signed and sent a letter dated January 18th to the Provincetown Select Board. It outlined their concerns about the recently announced plan to shutter LCAA and replace the service with 8 new paramedics in Truro and 8 firefighter medics in Provincetown, plus 8 returning summer rescue squad medics by July 1st. The transition plan, according to the letter's author, LCAA paramedic Patrick O'Neill, will leave Provincetown badly understaffed in 2023, with only 2 ambulance crews per shift in the height of summer. "We usually have 4 ambulances, and we're busy," O'Neill said. O'Neill wondered how Provincetown would be able to hire 8 paramedics with firefighting certifications in such a short time. He also asked how Provincetown could expect former LCAA medics who lack firefighting certification to work the summer and shoulder seasons without benefits. As it stands now, Provincetown's seasonal rescue squad is made up of LCAA employees who pull 80-hour weeks working for Provincetown seasonally, in addition to doing their year-round jobs for LCAA. Those leaving LCAA could be hired into full-time positions in a minute elsewhere, since there is a shortage of paramedics all across the Cape, he said. O'Neill said that a Provincetown's consultant, Norman Sylvester, who came up with the transition plan, is counting on former LCAA personnel working the summer standby positions without the guarantee of full-time employment and benefits. Then this town may find itself in the same position every single fire department on this peninsula finds itself in right now, grossly understaffed. "In life-or-death situations, experience matters," O'Neill told The Independent. "Without LCAA paramedics," he said, "the Outer Cape will lose valuable experience." Truro has been trying to hire 4 medics for months with no success. The town wants to hire an additional 4 in the next year. "None of the LCAA staff have applied for those jobs," said Truro town manager Darren Tangeman. O'Neill said Truro is not as desirable a place to work as Provincetown. "All I will say about that, on the record, is that the department does not have a good reputation," O'Neill said of Truro. Truro fire chief Tim Collins said, "Everyone's entitled to their opinion. That's all I'm going to say on that." On January 23rd, Provincetown fire chief Mike Travato and town manager Alex Morse presented an updated plan to the Select Board. It honors the requests of the LCAA staff. "We need them," Travato said. "There's a shortage of paramedics and EMTs, so we sat down and we realized that this is going to be a 3 to 5 year process. The people that we have, we need to keep them." Travato said he now wants to hire 16 people in 2023, including as many as he can from LCAA. He says he is prepared to provide year-round benefits, even for those who don't want to be firefighters, as is the case with O'Neill. Travato said he would be able to build the firefighting side of the department slowly, as long as the medical side is fully covered. "I want a one-word answer," Select Board member John Golden said to Travato on January 23rd. "Are you confident that we're going to be okay this summer with that plan?" Travato said, "I am confident." On January 24th, O'Neill said he was heartened by Travato's and Morse's new plan. "It is much better than what I heard just a few days ago. I'm pleased." Stan Sikorsky told the Select Board he hopes the transition from LCAA to town EMS departments will be seamless. In 2020, he said, "My heart stopped, and 6 minutes later, the rescue squad showed up and took over CPR from my wife and daughter. This is very critical." Next story is titled, "Social Worker Michelle Peterson Will Run Truro COA. More than 100 people gather to ask, who is going to be there for them?" by Casey Myers. Truro. The staffing shortage at the Truro Council on Aging, COA, has meant reduced services, including van rides and Friday lunches. But town manager Darren Tangeman told about 100 people who came to his January 19th presentation on the subject that the dry spell in hiring at the COA should be over by the end of this month. The COA is missing an office assistant, an outreach coordinator, two van drivers, and a cook. But as of January 23rd, there is a new COA deputy director, Eastham resident Michelle Peterson. She's a social worker who previously worked in long-term care at Liberty Commons in Chatham, she told The Independent. Her starting salary in Truro is $83,000. The role of COA director has been vacant for over a year, during which the town's whole organizational chart for community services changed. Darnion Clements, who had been the town's recreation director, was promoted to community services director. Then, two former director positions in recreation and at the COA became deputy director jobs. At the January 19th meeting, Tangeman told the audience that he wanted to implement this structure so that one supervisor can help when there are vacancies on either side of the community center. When COA outreach coordinator Elton Cutler resigned 2 weeks ago, shortly after the chef who prepared the Friday lunches departed, Clements and the new recreation director, Austin Smith, were able to pick up some of the work at the COA, Tangeman said. Meanwhile, Tangeman said interviews were underway for a new office assistant and outreach coordinator, and both jobs should be filled soon. Tangeman credited a pay increase for van drivers from $16 to $24 an hour, with several drivers' applications rolling in. But during the January 19th meeting, seniors wanted to know why there had been such a long-standing vacancy in the COA deputy director's role, and what the recent resignations of outreach coordinator Cutler and office assistant Chelsea Mix, who took a similar job at the Wellfleet Adult Community Center, were all about. They asked when the community center would reopen on Mondays, a pandemic-era closure that continues due to lack of staff, Clements said. Full staffing, Tangeman said, would allow the building to be open on Mondays. Without Cutler, seniors wanted to know, who will help them with Medicare forms? Breon Smith, head of Outer Cape Health Services Community Navigator Program, will reply to queries about Medicare, fuel assistance, and other services while the town finds a new outreach coordinator, Tangeman said. Who will help them fill out their tax forms? The AARP tax aid program will be held 2 days a week in February and March, said Clements. Mary Apt, who teaches ukulele at the COA, asked if the employees who recently left had been invited to apply for the open jobs or offered the higher salaries that resulted from a recent compensation classification study. Yes, Tangeman said, but they left anyhow for promotions in other towns. There is a regional staffing crisis, he said, and towns are now cannibalizing staff from other towns. When I look what's going on, I see a lot of administrators, and we have lost all our workers, Apt said. As a senior citizen, I have real concerns. Who's going to be there? Both Austin and Darnion are driving our vehicles to provide transportation services, Tangeman said. They will serve the community in whatever way they can while we get fully staffed, he added. Thank you for coming to the ends of the earth to take care of us, Apt said. Peterson, the new deputy director, was not at the meeting, but on January 24th, she told The Independent, I'm looking forward to bringing life back to the COA. She seemed confident she would soon have new colleagues to work with. We're on the cusp of making several hires, she said. Peterson has lived in Eastham for 7 years, though she's been coming to her family's home there since 1970, the year she was born, she said. She has two children, a daughter about to graduate from UMass, and a son who's a sophomore at Nauset Regional High School, she said. Peterson is a licensed social worker specializing in gerontology. Social work, however, is her second career. She graduated from LaSalle University in Hotel and Travel Administration and was a travel agent. Right after graduating, she owned Cape Cod Bicycle Tours with a partner. But then I realized I wanted to go back to school and do something to help people, she said. In 2000, Peterson got a master's degree in mental health counseling from the University of St. Joseph in West Hartford, Connecticut. She lived in Holden and worked for 8 years at the Jewish Healthcare Center, a nursing home in Worcester, mostly as a medical social worker. She's currently studying to become a licensed mental health counselor through the Department of Gerontology at UMass Boston, according to a press release from Tangeman. Peterson is knowledgeable at navigating the healthcare system and has significant expertise in care management applications, including Medicare, Medicaid, current state health regulations, and much more, Tangeman stated. The next story is an obituary. a journalist and advocate of both history and progress, Theodore Thomas Jones dies at 65, by Tom Recchio. Ted Jones loved Provincetown with a passion. More precisely, he had four, his husband, Peter Paytas, said, affordable housing, the history of Provincetown art and architecture, the removal of single-use plastic containers from the environment, and his garden. Theodore Thomas Jones died at New York Presbyterian Hospital on January 11, 2023. He had been diagnosed with metastatic gastric cancer on Christmas Eve. Ted was 65. The youngest of Frank and Bee Jones' four children, Ted was born on August 13, 1957, in Edina, Minnesota, and grew up in that leafy Minneapolis suburb. From a young age, he was curious and fearless. A family story has it that, when he was four, he borrowed his five-year-old brother's two-wheel bike and rode it 5 miles to his grandmother's house, his dog running along beside him. His brother had not yet learned to ride the bike. His father owned a lumber company where Ted learned how to work with wood and drive a forklift. He was an excellent student, graduating from Edina East High School in 1975 and enrolling at the University of Minnesota that fall. Although he entered in the class of 1979, Ted remained in college for 7 years, completing a double major in English and art history with a minor in photography. Wanting to write, Ted took a job as a journalist with the Minneapolis Star and Tribune in the early 1980s, starting with obituaries before covering local news. In 1985, he pitched a story on the odd museums of England, which would, of course, require that he travel there. The article on the Toy Soldier Museum in Norfolk, the Derwent Pencil Museum, home of the first pencil, the Dog Collar Museum in Leeds, and the Royal Coaches Museum at Buckingham Palace was syndicated nationally. Ted left the paper to look for work in New York City in 1991. His first job there was with Home Mechanics magazine, where he was the remodeling editor. He subsequently worked as an editor for the Times Mirror Company and the New York Times Magazine Group, writing on remodeling. He wrote features for American Home Style and Gardening. On March 15, 1992, Ted met Peter Paytas at a bar in the East Village. Peter gave Ted his business card, and when Ted called, they arranged to meet the following Thursday. But Ted called back an hour later. They went out the next day, and ever since, Peter said, we made each other laugh every day. Ted was intrigued by history and its lessons for social change. After reading that Andrew Carnegie had helped build public libraries in 1,419 small towns, Ted delved into that story. His book, Carnegie Libraries Across America, A Public Legacy, published by Wiley in 1997, is the only comprehensive history of the libraries Carnegie built. Many people believe that when you've seen one Carnegie library, you've seen them all, Ted wrote, and nothing could be further from the truth. Each library was a separate and intentional design effort to construct a landmark. Each played a surprisingly important role in the vast social changes that occurred at the turn of the century, which included women's suffrage, museum development, the movies, the budding labor movements, education, philanthropy, and other vital issues. The year 1997 was also when Ted and Peter bought an apartment together in New York City. That summer, Ted found a place in Provincetown's East End that allowed vacationers to bring their dogs. Ted had had no idea about Provincetown's thriving gay culture, Peter said. 1 week in the East End in 1997 turned into many more weeks in subsequent years. In 2005, Ted and Peter bought the flagship, the remains of the old-school restaurant opened in 1935 by Manuel Francis Patrick that had replaced a Prohibition-era nightclub next door to the Beachcombers on Commercial Street, according to David W. Dunlap's Building Provincetown. They settled in year-round in 2007 and spent 2012 renovating the building into a single residence. Ted's reverence for history showed in the changes the couple made, including bringing the house back to its original 1911 configuration and keeping the flagship's 1940s-era Dory Bar. The spirit of the flagship endures, though it's a private home now, wrote Dunlap, and as long as there's a Dory Bar in place, there will always be a flagship. Ted loved the texture of his daily life, especially living in the flagship and gardening. When people paused in their walks to admire his garden, he would always engage, Peter said, and his garden was much admired and photographed. During the pandemic, his garden was included in the Provincetown Art Association and Museum's virtual video tour of the town. And that is all from the Provincetown Independent for this week. We will be back next week.